hadn't been intoxicated, he could have possibly avoided the tree, or he could have, what is your position on what your quantum of proof would be on causation?
We agree that we must prove, with the preponderance of the evidence, that there was a causal link, proximate causal link, between the intoxication and the injury, and the inability to hit the tree.
Not just the mere driving.
That's correct. The driving...
You assert, then, that the mere driving while drunk is negligence.
Is negligence. Or the jury could so find.
You assert, then, that negligence can become a proximate cause, depending upon the fact of what happened at the accident site itself.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the jury...
Under traditional rules of foreseeability and that sort of thing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that ought to be submitted as a part of a broad form proximate cause.
You talk issue. About broad issue. Of course, Lemus versus Montes, I guess, is our approval of the broad issue. If you got here measuring conduct in a product's liability sense against negligent conduct on the part of Poole, how would you submit a broad issue taking in consideration Cessna in this case?
I would submit the broad issue on the plaintiff's negligence with an instruction as to what constitutes negligence in a product liability case under the terms of Duncan.
Well, talk about negligence. I mean, in Lemus versus Montes, we said whose negligence, if any, I think, proximately caused the occurrence in question. That's about as broad as you can get. Can you use that combination products liability, alleged negligent, contributory negligent context?
In a case such as this, I would submit that it would be better to submit a negligence issue. Was the plaintiff contributorily negligent? Broad form in that sense, and then an instruction as to what constitutes contributory negligence in a products case as opposed to a normal non-products case, and then the proximate cause issue in broad form, whether there was proximate causation with appropriate instruction.
Does that run counter to Cessna?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I'm not arguing that negligent failure to discover the defect should be submitted. I would instruct the jury that as to what types of negligence can constitute contributory negligence in a products case as opposed to a negligence case. But that could be handled by an instruction and the issue submitted as a contributory negligence issue properly instructed.
Assuming it does not fall within the prohibition that in a products case you cannot submit the plaintiff's failure to discover, what case law do you have that it's an appropriate defense in a product liability case in any of them?
That the plaintiff's contributory negligence?
The driving while intoxicated, particularly, that I'm referring to here.
Well, this is negligence on the part of the plaintiff that is irrespective of the defect. If the product hadn't been defective, it could have been a child on the road or a motorist come across the road. This court has not specifically addressed exactly what counts as Duncan negligence and what does not. The California Supreme Court in Daly versus General Motors, the leading case on fault and comparative allocation that was cited by Duncan and one of the leading cases that applied the comparative scheme to a products case, that case in fact involved a drunk driver, the negligence of the plaintiff in that case. There were other alleged negligent acts as well, but it involved drunk driving. I'd like to make just one other quick point.
Do you think this falls within the scheme of comparative fault in Duncan, or that it's necessary for this court to articulate it further?
I think this does fall within the comparative scheme, that this does not present a problem of mere failure to discover or guard against the defect. This is independent negligence because it creates risk independently. Exactly where the court will draw that line is going to be a problem in future cases, but this would be independent contributory negligence. I'd like to make just one other very quick point, as my time is running short, on this issue. The plaintiff cites all kinds of cases that intoxication in and of itself cannot be negligence. And we agree with that. The Benoit case, cases of that type, where The plaintiff, in that case, was merely intoxicated in his motel room. We agree that mere intoxication is not in and of itself negligent, but the act of driving while intoxicated, we would assert, is a very different matter.
Of course, you keep assuming that he was intoxicated.
Yes, I'd like to address that.
What you're telling the tennis court is probably as a matter of law, he was intoxicated.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But you, I mean, all your whole argument is assuming that the man was intoxicated.
Yes, and we feel that the Court of Appeals was correct in that he was intoxicated and that the evidence overwhelmingly showed he was intoxicated, notwithstanding the evidence to which Mr. Houston refers. That the evidence, in fact, overwhelmingly showed that that Ronnie Poole was intoxicated when he was at the wheel. And I'd like to amplify that for a moment, if I might. What the plaintiff, in terms of the factual sufficiency point, is asking this court to do is go back through all of the evidence and weigh it. And this court in Poole 1 described very specifically what the Court of Appeals was to do in reviewing a factual sufficiency point. It was to outline the evidence, compare it, and determine whether it was against the great weight and sufficiency of the evidence. Now, if this were a no evidence point, we would agree that there is some evidence, there's more than a scintilla of evidence, on the side that he was not intoxicated. We're not offering a no evidence point. And the Court of Appeals simply said there ought to be a new trial because it's against the great weight of the evidence, a factual sufficiency point. And in fact, by asking this court to go back through and weigh the evidence, the plaintiff would ask the court to actually read Article 5, Section 6 out of the Constitution, rather than simply assure itself of the fact that the Court of Appeals went through the appropriate steps.
Let me interrupt you here and talk about the difference between insufficiency and against the great weight of the ponderance. Do you think a different standard should attain? Here you've got the jury, since the Chief Justice Gaines in 1898 wrote the courts of appeal don't find facts, they unfind facts.
Yes, sir.
What you have here is a jury's failure to find because they answered we do not or something equivalent to the intoxication issue. And the Supreme Court says the Court of Appeals says this is against the great weight of preponderance. It's not as if they had found it and the Court of Appeals said, well, the evidence was insufficient to support the finding. Do you think when a jury has failed to find from a preponderance of the evidence and the Court of Appeals comes in and says that's against the great weight preponderance, that in effect constitutes a finding of fact by the Court of Appeals as opposed to insufficiency?
We would argue that that's not a finding by the Court of Appeals. The difference between finding a fact and unfinding a fact, in our opinion, is the difference between rendering a judgment, actually inserting the fact and rendering a judgment, and just undoing what the trial court did, unfinding what the trial court did and sent it back. And on this regard, I point out that in Ray King's estate, the fact there, which was under scrutiny for factual sufficiency, was a fact that was found against the proponent. And the Court of Appeals held that the finding against the proponent, just as in this case, was against the great weight and sufficiency of the evidence. And the Supreme Court held in its consideration of In re King's estate that that was within the appropriate role of the Court of Appeals, that that was the type of unfinding, not dealing with who was the proponent in the case, but whether the case was going to simply be sent back to the trial court or it was going to be a judgment was going to be rendered. So we would assert that In re King's estate is direct authority for the proposition that factual sufficiency can be in favor of the proponent or can be used in favor of the proponent as well as against the proponent on a point. Okay. My time's running short. I'd like to simply point out some uncontroverted facts at the trial court. Well, 2 points. First, the Court of Appeals did go through and consider all of the evidence. Mr. Houston, in his brief, especially at page 16 of his reply brief, continually says the Court of Appeals left out some of the evidence. A careful examination of the record and the Court of Appeals demonstrates that the Court of Appeals did go through every piece of evidence that Mr. Houston refers to. Sometimes they refer to these people as receptionists or as brother rather than using their names, but every bit of this evidence, including the signature, including the steps, including the road, all of that was considered by the Court of Appeals. And whatever else Ronnie Poole was doing that evening, it is uncontroverted in this case that he had a 0.119 blood alcohol level. Now, some people may not have noticed that he was intoxicated at the dance. Some people may not have noticed alcohol at the scene. They were too preoccupied by doing other things. It's very traumatic to come upon the scene of an accident. But one thing remains. He had a 0.119 alcohol level 2 hours after the accident occurred and would have metabolized alcohol during that period of time. So that fact is not controverted. There is nothing in the record whatever to undermine the validity of that hospital test. And all of the other evidence, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, is fully consistent with this, that sometimes people didn't see him while he was intoxicated. He could do some types of acts without being noticed as being intoxicated, but nevertheless, he had a point or higher than a 0.119 alcohol level at the scene of the accident. And since that overwhelmingly shows he was intoxicated at the time of the accident, the jury's finding on the intoxication issue should be factually insufficient. The case should be remanded for a refinding on that particular issue, and then whether his intoxication was proximately related to the injuries, we can deal with at the during the next trial. I'd like to make just one point on remittiture. My time is running out. I'd like to simply point out that, again, what the plaintiff is asking this court to do is to go back through and actually weigh the evidence. And as this court, just as recently as last week in the Salinas versus Fort Worth cab case, said that on factual sufficiency points, and that was both for exemplary damages and actual damages, on remittiture, that, quote, this is a question of fact over which this court has no jurisdiction. And so that we would strongly stand by the arguments we've made in our brief, even though I'm not able to make them here today, that the Court of Appeals, just like on the factual sufficiency of the plaintiff's contributory negligence, went rigorously through the steps that this court instructed it to do in Pool 1, that it did the same thing on the remittiture point as well. And the plaintiff points out that this is a case just like Pope versus Moore. In fact, this is a case very different than Pope versus Moore, where in Pope versus Moore it was clear that the court on the remittiture point used the incorrect standard by saying the evidence was factually sufficient, but nevertheless remitted the damages. Here the court held that the evidence was factually insufficient. A comparison of the court's review for factual sufficiency in this case on both issues is also highlighted by a comparison with Lofton versus Texas Grind Corporation and Alcoa versus Alm. Two cases where this court has recently considered factual sufficiency points. In those cases, the court did not consider the evidence of the plaintiff, where in our case, the court did. We ask the Court of Appeals be affirmed and the case remanded.
Would you answer one question on my time, please? Other than the highway patrolman's testimony that he detected the odor of alcohol on and about the body of Ronnie Poole, and the notation in the hospital records of 0.119 blood alcohol content, now is that the sum total of evidence of intoxication? Is there any other evidence?
There had been, again, uncontroverted testimony that he'd been drinking beer that evening. So that's in the record. He had a beer with him, a cold half can of beer with him at the time of the accident.
Okay.
That's uncontroverted. And there's testimony from experts that alcohol contributed to the accident. So there is much more evidence in the record than the mere .119. But what we would argue is that is direct, uncontroverted testimony of his blood alcohol level, and that makes him intoxicated. We also refer to other evidence in our brief.
How soon after the wreck was the blood alcohol test taken that showed the one over?
Approximately 2 hours. By the time he'd been taken to one hospital and then transferred to another hospital. And in that period of time, he would have metabolized some of that alcohol, as our expert testified.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hey, please, Court.
Mr. Houston, on this notation, hospital record concerning contents of his blood and alcohol, is there any testimony as to who gave him that?
No.
That test, is no. How that arrived on the records or anything of that nature?
No, sir.
What you're saying is that was just on the record?
That's in the record, Your Honor, and my honest recollection is how it came up that Dr. Ulrich, who was the doctor who was called in to at the Tyler Hospital to see Ronnie Pulak, was brought over there. He came and he attended him, and sometime later he saw that, my gut feeling is, we saw it when he was preparing to testify in the case, and was there. We argued, and this is just argument, jury argument, and I hate to do a disservice to this court and my obligation as a lawyer, as an officer of the court. We argued to the jury that since there's no evidence there of it, there's absolutely no other testimony that he was intoxicated, that he was brought in this terrible condition he was in, and they took blood samples that he was doing in the hospital, and they swabbed his arm with alcohol to do that, and just stuck that on there, and this very possibly is an explanation for it to how that happened.
The jury didn't buy that, though, did they?
Well, they found he wasn't intoxicated.
Well, they found he was. I think they bought it. They nodded their head with me when I said yes, it was an explanation of it, John. It was one of the explanations, because to answer the judge's question, there's just no evidence in the record as to what it was there for.
Or who took it, or how it arrived on the shore.
No.
Thank you.
There may be a
swabbed on the arm, somehow might have gotten in the blood of the examiner.
Yes. There's a case I cite in the brief at some place, there's an appellate court that I cite in my brief, I believe, where this was an explanation offered by the court as to possibility. Going back to the question of intoxication, very briefly, Your Honor, the question that you asked of Professor Powers was that he's ignoring on the question of intoxication that the law of this state has always been, and goes up to the newest case, the Hughes case, that said that intoxication itself is not an ultimate question of fact, that if a man was intoxicated, you still must prove a specific act of negligence. The intoxication is evidentiary only of those other acts of negligence. Those acts of negligence from Ford's pleading were submitted to the jury, and the jury found them against Ford, that Poole was not negligent in veering off the road, driving at speed, and etc. So those were their selected acts of negligence that have been found against them. He says that they went vigorously through damages that the Court of Appeals did, and this prohibits you from reviewing it. Well, they didn't vigorously go through damages. They very vigorously said that we find so-and-so. For instance, as I said, that there's no pain, no physical pain, that which is absolutely ridiculous, if you'll pardon the expression, for a court in this condition. Had a jury found zero on the question of pain, I think the law of Texas is that as a matter of law, it would have had to been set aside, because it doesn't, and the Court of Appeals should not be permitted to so find. It might be of interest to know that on the question of the intoxication, it's whether it's an ultimate question of fact or not, there's no pleading by Ford of a statutory violation on intoxication. They pled simply that he was driving while intoxicated, no statute or anything. counsel now, Professor Flowers, is wanting you to do this to say that there is a presumption. He wants to go back, and the tone of his argument is that there should be a presumption, simply because there's a notation in the record that he had a 0.119 blood alcohol content, that somehow this is automatic intoxication.
We wrote on that.
Yeah, well, you've already written on that, and that's out of case.
We wrote on that pool one, but I don't understand that to be his argument
all right.
in this case.
Then I missed it. That was the conception that I had of it. Your Honor, unless there's some further questions from the court, I think that we've completely covered it, and this will conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. I want to announce to the other case coming in that I will not sit in that case. The other members of the court will be sitting.
Your Honor,
we'll take a short recess.
May I have leave to file a short supplemental brief that I have?
Certainly, Mr. Houston.
And will, Your Honor?
And 7 days thereafter, if you care to reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The counsel is also in error in saying that there is no claim that this type of permitting does not fit in with a comprehensive plan. We had a point in the court below and this court to that effect. Jumping back to the summary judgment point, on its face, the judgment shows that there was no motion for summary judgment filed by the city. And therefore, on its face, it shows that it's not a final judgment. It says, came on to be heard the motion for summary judgment filed by the defendants, Duddleston, and the partnership. At that time, the parties appeared for the hearing, and the court considered it. And the court, having considered it, finds that there's no genuine issue of material fact, and finds that as a matter of law, a summary judgment should be granted in favor of defendants Wayne B. Duddleston and the partnership. So on its face, it shows that the city was not disposed of except in the decretal portions that follow that.
And there was no severance.
There was no severance, that's correct.
Do you dispute Mr. Oak's contention that the only thing your declaratory judgment sought was to test the validity of three ordinances?
No, sir, I don't dispute that.
And did the summary judgment dispose of those three ordinances?
It did in the decretal part, that's true. But here, if there had been a summary judgment in favor of the city, then that would have been binding upon the other defendants. But the reverse is not true. In a general situation, a determination between private individuals as to the validity of city ordinance does not bind the city. Here, the city made no effort to uphold the validity of the ordinance. I don't think that the plaintiffs were called upon to make the same kind of case when represented simply by the defendants that it would have been called upon if the city had been in there moving for summary judgment. But aside from the jurisdictional point, if you say this is a fine on its face, there's still the issue of a lack of power in the court to do it. And we cite in all briefs and all courts numerous cases that all hold that there is no power in a court to grant summary judgment to the party that has it moving. In fact, this court in the Exxon case said we are not to be understood as authorizing a trial court to grant affirmative relief to a party in the absence of such party's motion for summary judgment. We submit the case should be reversed.